Hello, and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, your weekly cybersecurity news and threat research podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest Threat Research Team. I'm Kim, and I'm your host for today's episode, while Chris takes a well-deserved break. And I'm joined by one of our threat hunters, Brian. How are you today, Brian?
Hey, Kim. Not too bad. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. I think the last time we did the podcast together, we were in Dublin together.
Yeah, that was actually nice getting to do it in person as well.
It was nice hanging out with all you guys. So last week, I think, was quite a busy one here at ReliaQuest because we had our customer conference, Exponent. So I think, as we mentioned on the last podcast, there was over 500 of our customers all in Tampa getting to hear about what we do, how we do it, and people giving different presentations. So I know Markin, who's a podcast favorite, did a BEC talk. That's right, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, they had a really interesting talk on BEC. It was one of the hot topics over there as well.
That's cool. And so hopefully if anyone listening managed to get themselves to Exponent, they were also able to meet some of the threat research team in real life and grill them about all the different topics we talk about on here. But I guess it was also a bit of a busy time across the threat landscape. So we have some interesting topics to chat through on this episode. So first off, we're going to talk about a new backdoor that was discovered at the end of last week. So a Microsoft engineer revealed that the backdoor had been intentionally placed in xzutils, which is an open source data compression utility available on almost all installations of Linux and other Unix-like operating systems. And it was reported that if that instance had been successfully installed, then that would allow attackers to circumvent authentication and also remotely access entire systems. So, Brian, can you tell us more about the compromise, how it worked, how long it's been in the works, all the details that people need to know?
Yeah, so it's one thing that I mentioned, like, Art, that I was looking at it while I was reading up on it, was that the sophistication behind the whole thing and the kind of was really long and drawn out, as in, like, how much work that went into it. But essentially, this backdoor creates an avenue that allows for remote code execution on systems that accept SSH connections. And in terms of, like, I suppose when the groundwork started, which is, I think, is really interesting in terms of sophistication and the kind of drive behind these adversaries, was it started back in about, I'd say, February 2022, when Jiatan, excuse my pronunciation if that's incorrect, he kind of became more involved with the xzutil kind of project. They did push, like, a patch to it before in 2022. In February, and that kind of got some attention of some never seen before accounts, kind of arguing that, you know, the project needs to be maintained better, and kind of like trying to get legitimacy on Joy to kind of get more involved the project, essentially get more commit permissions. So in early 2023, Gia received commit permissions to the XZ utilities project, and from here Joy made a pull request to OSS Fuzz, which is essentially a project used to identify bugs and vulnerabilities or unexpected behaviors. So it's believed now, looking back, that was done to prevent OSS Fuzz from identifying any malicious code in QZ that leveraged indirect function, which was used by the backdoor.
Okay, that's really interesting. So that's like a long-term campaign, basically, like laying the groundwork, getting some trust within that kind of community of looking after this open source tool, I guess. And then so that, if I understand right, so that when they made the malicious code changes, they would go unnoticed. Is that right?
Essentially, yeah. Like, so it'll go unchecked by, I suppose, like themselves as an OSS fuzz. So it's kind of given them the lay of the land and they can kind of do what they wish.
Yeah, well, yeah. So that is good sophistication. And I guess combining kind of that malicious code writing with a bit of social engineering as well, which is a topic we will go on to talk about more in the podcast. So, Brian, I know from my research that this was caught early, and luckily the engineer spotted it. But how big would you say the impact of this could have been had it not been discovered and people started downloading this buggy version?
Yeah, I suppose the impact would have been quite widespread. And I think it would have definitely taken us a surprise. Like, I suppose incident responders kind of looking at it, I suppose they can see like anomalous activity on certain hosts and stuff like that. It would have taken a little bit longer to kind of come around to see what's actually after happening. But thankfully, we were quick enough to catch it. So,
yeah. And I think I also read that, because when we all think of supply chain attacks, we all think of SolarWinds, right? From 3.5 years ago now. But I also read that people were saying that this could have actually been way bigger than SolarWinds, because it could have impacted all of Linux, which is used far more widespread than the SolarWinds Orion platform was. So it's really interesting, and it kind of brings up some interesting points around like how difficult it can be to maintain open source software, how difficult it can be to find changes when people have been manipulating this software, and then also kind of the length of access that some threat actors are able to get within these things before they get noticed. So you kind of wonder, how many more of these are there out there that haven't been noticed yet and are just kind of freewheeling within people's systems that we don't know about yet? I'm sure they will come out. But I thought it was also interesting, this Geotan individual that was involved, I guess the naming of it suggests a Chinese or an Asian element. But then the timing of the code commits that this individual was making align with them being in Eastern Europe. So it's another attribution challenge for people to figure out who this person is, what their motive is, but that kind of long-term access that we've seen aligns with like nation-state activity a bit more. And we know in the last couple of months, like Russian threat actors have been targeting big US tech firms like Microsoft. And interestingly, today, I think in the last couple of days, the US Department of Homeland Security released a review of the Microsoft Exchange intrusion conducted by APT29. So I haven't read it yet. It's quite long. I think the executive summary is 2 whole pages, which isn't really a summary when it gets to that long. But anyway. Yeah. But I'll be interested to read that and see what it says and see what comes out of that. But I did note that Microsoft completed an analysis of competing hypothesis exercise, which we also did when I was in Dublin with you guys. But they had 46 different hypotheses as to how the threat actor might have got access to Exchange Online. And then apparently they were still considering those 46 9 months into the exercise. So maybe a smaller number would have been better, but who am I to judge? Anyway, do we have any recommendations for people that might be using XZ utils or Linux versions that are affected?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose the obvious one would be to downgrade to an older version, anything before 5.60. After that, that's the ones that we're, I suppose, off the back door. So any versions before that would be best.
Nice. Thank you very much. Okay, so moving on to our next topic. Our Spotlight report this week is focused on SEO poisoning. So for anyone that isn't familiar with that term, search engine optimization is used by big search engines, all of them, to determine which websites are most likely to be useful to a user who's conducting a search. And then it will deliver those most useful results at the top of the search list. So in SEO poisoning, threat actors manipulate those searching algorithms and they boost their own website search rankings, making legitimate users like you and me more likely to visit a nefarious site over a legitimate site. So Brian, based on our report and what we found, can you explain how SEO poisoning works and the different techniques that can be used?
Yeah, so like you said, Kim, it's to manipulate search engine algorithms. So essentially putting these malicious websites in the top results. And like how we do that, or how threat actors do that, is by creating or leveraging websites and implanting keywords or like, you know, typical search terms, like common search terms. So like, for example, if I was to search for COVID related information or vaccines and stuff like that, I would likely get results based on those websites having those keywords in it. And whether or not they're, you know, legitimate is another thing. So that was something that was actually highly exploited back in the day when we were going through COVID. But yeah, so keywords are one of the main things as well that'll come up. And it's a very effective thing. We've seen with Gutloader being leveraging that as well. And it's kind of like the Wild West when you're looking at, when you're putting the kind of control in the hands of the user, essentially, anything forward proxy related, it's very hard to control.
I see. And I think one of the other areas we explored within the report was why this technique is so popular with threat actors, but also why it's so successful in terms of capturing legitimate users and then delivering malicious payloads or capturing the credentials of these individuals. And I think one of the main reasons is that the spread and the reach that threat actors can have is much wider with SEO poisoning. So it's kind of going to reach anybody that's searching for a particular term, as opposed to, say, phishing, where you're having to find the email addresses of people and then deliver the mail shots into their inbox. And then coupled with that, when you're searching online, you are specifically looking for information. You want to absorb information, so you're more likely to kind of click on different links to try and find out what's going on. Whereas, I don't know, when you get an email that you haven't solicited into your inbox, you're less likely to interact with that, especially if you're kind of au fait with cybersecurity. You're definitely going to be more critical of a random email that just comes into your inbox. You know, we also have a lot of trust in big search engines, like big tech companies. We think that the things that they deliver to us when we search for things are going to be legitimate. We take that for granted. You know, if it's nestled amongst other legitimate results, then we're gonna trust it. You know, we want things at the top of that list. I know when I'm kind of researching what I'm going to buy, maybe I don't normally go past the first page of results, because for me, most of the relevant things are going to be in that page. And then once you get further down, you start getting all the junk and all the what I think are going to be fake sites that are going to steal my money. So yeah, it's interesting that threat actors have kind of clasped on to that human nature involved in searching for things. And now that we're in this kind of technological age where we rely on that so much, they've kind of stepped in and taken advantage of that. I've rambled enough. How can we hunt for SEO poisoning attacks, Brian?
Yeah, so that's, I think it's an interesting hunt, to say the least. So we can pull from two telemetry sets, one being for proxy and the other being endpoint. And what we can do is we can pull all URLs, all full URLs from proxy logs, and kind of like look for certain parameters. So like search terms or even the keyword search. So typically like with Google, you'll have google.com/search? And then followed by your keywords and stuff like that. So we can pull the likes of those logs, and we can kind of like, I suppose, look for common things that we typically see people searching. So it's kind of like turning it back around on the other side as well. We're also looking for the keywords. And then when we've identified those keywords, we can circle back into our endpoint telemetry to look for the likes of file downloads and stuff like that. And typically, and why we take from the two is because typically the search terms that the users look for ends up being the exact same name as the file that's downloaded. So if I searched for COVID information I'd probably get like a COVID PDF, like COVID information PDF, or XE, or so on and so forth. And then we can kind of tie things in together from there, and kind of map it back. So it's definitely something that you kind of have to take offline. The majority of SimTools don't have the capability to kind of like map everything in together and kind of correlate that stuff. But it's a very interesting one, I have to say.
Nice. So it's like a two-pronged approach, and it requires a bit more human interaction, I guess, to kind of get to the bottom of those hunts.
Yeah, definitely a bit more manual in there. But we do, and this is where another thing where we can bring in as well is in terms of like machine learning or using models and stuff like that to kind of help us identify those anomalies in terms of those keyword searches and or kind of training on these things that we're looking for. And even looking at kind of, I suppose, certain levels of contamination that we expect in a data set, as in like how do I judge, what do I expect an anomaly to be in this data set? Is it 1%, 2%, 3%, and so on? So there's a lot of ways we can look at it. So there is definitely something we could do. But it's definitely more of a hunt rather than something that you could possibly build a detection on.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Good for people to know that as well, for if they're interested in detections versus hunting. Okay, and then what can listeners do to spot these kinds of attacks or prevent themselves from falling victim to SEO poisoning?
Yeah, well, it's because it is so good, and like what threat actors are doing is really it's really impactful. You can put in blocks on your proxy. You can block certain site categories and stuff like that, or even certain types of extensions. But typically, there's always a way they can get back in. But I think good rule of thumb is to always put in protections on your phone proxy, blocking sites, certain kind of like extensions and stuff like that. And then as well as that, from an endpoint perspective, only allow, I suppose, like typically we probably see JS files being downloaded. Make sure that users do not have the ability to double click on them, so that won't be executed by WScript. Have the JS file being opened in a text editor rather than being executed on the machine. The list goes on and on, but those are the ones that I would, you know, put up straight away. It's definitely, if you were to put in those protections, there's definitely going to be some kickback from the internal users anyway, because I always go to this site, or you know what I mean? So it's a hit and miss with, you know, the proxy. So
yeah, it's another one of those balancing acts between security and usability for the people in your organization, isn't it? I think having or blocking those file downloads is really important, because like you say, it's hard to identify the illegitimate sites because of how sophisticated they look, and they're only going to get more sophisticated as we start using AI and machine learning and all that sort of stuff. But if you can't download a file, then that's going to be great protection. So if you listening at home are interested in learning more about SEO poisoning, then you can read the full report on our website in the blog section. That's up now as I speak. So yeah, if you're interested, head over to the ReliaQuest website in the blog section and you can read more about SEO poisoning. And there's also a case study in that report of what we found in customers' environments as well. So it's a really interesting read. Okay, on to the final topic for today is kind of following the theme of social engineering. We're talking about impersonation scams. So according to statistics collated by the US Federal Trade Commission earlier this week, losses in the US because of impersonation scams exceeded $1.1 billion last year, so 2023. And that figure is three times higher than what they recorded in 2020. And the agency based the calculation on nearly 500,000 reported scams in a year. So the report found that most scams were conducted by phone calls, which I found quite interesting, since we quite often think of emails when we're working on a cybersecurity setting. But the phone call method is actually in decline since 2020. So it used to be responsible for about 67% of scams, and that's dropped down to 32%. which is quite a big drop, really. And then scams conducted by email have grown from 10% to 26% over the same time. And then text messages have also increased a small amount. I think they went from 9% to 14%. So I guess what I think in my head is kind of slowly being reflected in those stats that the Federal Trade Commission has collected. So Brian, like, what kind of impersonation scams do we see most in our customer environments, would you say?
Yeah, we definitely obviously see them coming through, I suppose, emails. Of course, that's always going to be a thing. But I suppose that the most impactful ones that we've seen is phone calls coming in, getting directly onto the IT support, you know, asking them, can we get set up on and get a new MFA device set up, or can I get a password reset? And those ones can be quite impactful in terms of if it is successful and the IT help desk do help them out and essentially gives the actors initial access and they're in. And I don't see that by any means going down. Because I, correct me if I'm wrong, this was a thing brought up in terms of like voice impersonation over an exponent. I don't think that's necessarily new by any means, but it's definitely getting better. So it's going to be interesting to see what comes from that.
Yeah, I think Chris, who normally hosts the podcast, was at Exponent, and he mentioned the voice impersonator to me, and that it was really impressive, the tool we had. So I think, you know, if we have it, then I'm sure multiple other organizations and have it, and then there are always threat actors ready to make use of legitimate tools in their attacks. So yeah, that kind of scares me a little bit, because we put our voices out onto the internet by doing this podcast, and so anyone can take that and use it using one of these tools, yeah, which is a bit scary. But I think, you know, we've talked about it a lot with the use of AI and how that's going to start changing the way cyber criminals, or enhancing the way they operate, probably throughout this year and into next year. And then into next year, I think we'll see the full effects and like ripple effects of what that change does to attack numbers and successful attack numbers, for example. Why do you think impersonation scams are continually on the rise and continually cause such exponential losses across organizations? Like, 1.1 billion is a lot of money. So why do we keep falling for them, basically?
Yeah, well, I suppose from the threat actor's perspective, what's like, you know, don't try and fix what's not broken. You know, if it continues to work, you know, if not put more energy into it, and if we're backed with the likes of AI and stuff like that to make things seem better, more convincing, more legitimate, it's just going to keep going. I definitely think one of the quickest and easiest ways is to hit an organization is through the likes of those impersonating calls into IT help desk and getting it through that way. It's you know, it's very advantageous for threat actors or even initial access brokers to go about it that way, or take that avenue, because it's either you're going to get told, no, we can't do that, you know, you're going to have to review the process and how we do that, or the IT guy is going to be very helpful and get you right in. So
yeah, it plays on our human nature to try and be helpful towards other people, doesn't it? And I think most people try and do what they can to help others out in time of need, especially if you've got someone calling in, like, I need to be in a meeting in 10 minutes, I've been locked out, please, you need to help me, like really piling on the pressure and the sob stories, then you probably catch a few people out. And I think we've also talked about a lot that the human is the weakest link in the cybersecurity chain. And so, like you said, threat actors know that, they know these techniques work. And so why change it when it works so well?
Yep.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your input today. I know it was a lot of pressure on you being my only guest this week, but I think we've had some good discussions, and yeah, it's really nice to hear a bit more about like insights from the threat hunting side as well. So if you at home like what you have heard today or want to know more, then please help us by liking and subscribing Shadow Talk on whichever platform you listen to, like recommend us to friends or colleagues so that we can increase our reach as much as possible. Chris will be back next week, I'm sure, and order will be resumed. And then we'll see you all then, or you'll hear us then. Anyway, thank you, Brian, and I hope you have a good rest of your week, and I'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.